to order the House Ag Policy Committee, and we will begin with House File 3203, but I'm just going to talk about it this morning a little bit. We do have this bill that we're going to hear and have some testimony on. When it comes to conclusion, then it will be moved to Rules Committee. Because we're past deadlines, so we're not actually moving it to another committee at this point for other action other than to rules. And there, from there, if it moves on, it's up to Representative Clark Johnson and others to have that happen. Pressure's on him. But other than that, after we conclude that bill, then we are going to have an informational hearing talking about urban agriculture a little bit. We have a couple of bills that Representative Karen Clark introduced, and some people wanted to be able to speak on that and talk about some issues they have around the area of urban agriculture. So we'll spend some time doing that. But so at the beginning here, we do have a quorum, so I'm going to start out first with just approval of minutes. We have a couple of packets of minutes, and I am wondering if Representative Anderson will move the March 19th and the March 20th minutes. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion approved. Thank you. And so now we have House File 3203, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Good morning, everybody. House File 3203, comes out of a need that exists in my hometown of Mankato. I actually live in North Mankato, but in Mankato is located an industry called MTU Onsite Energy. You might recognize them as Cato Light or Cato Engineering. They are a longtime employer in our region. They employ more than a couple of hundred folks and are really they manufacture diesel generators, electronic generators, and their issue is they sell these globally. They have a worldwide marketing system, and some countries don't use biodiesel, and so they do their research and development in Mankato, and I appropriately ask that they be able to use regular diesel for the research and development of those generators that are marketed in places that do not use biodiesel, so they can remain competitive on the international market. And if you look at the third page of the bill, you'll see under I should probably move the delete all amendment. Okay.
That would
Let
be
me
good.
Do that first, okay? Thank you.
All right, so we have before us the H3203DE1. That is the delete everything amendment. And we will have that moved, and all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. So that's what's before us.
Yeah, thank you. And so going to line 3.11 and 3.12, you can see where that challenge is addressed in that part of the bill. We are making a few other changes with respect to the biodiesel law, and I'm going to ask Jerry Schoenfeld, representing the soybean growers, to explain those.
Thank you. And welcome to the committee. If you identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Jerry Schoenfeld. I work with Minnesota Soybean Growers and the Minnesota Biodiesel Council. There are a few other changes, and I would indicate that this year probably many of you have heard about discussions about biodiesel. This is, I think, the fourth time that we've had biodiesel debate before the legislature since its inception. Biodiesel originally came in the year 2000 with the first introduction of the B2 bill to put in place a B2 requirement. It was debated for approximately 2 years at that time. In 2008, Governor Pawlenty moved forward on higher levels, going from B2, B5 up to B10, B20, and that's what the law exists at the present time. At that time, there was a lot of debate that took place for that issue, and then a couple of years ago we also had debate about some of the extension of the some sunsets that existed in the law from 2008, and we're here before you again today, and there has been a lot of discussion, and I guess that some of the other portions of the delete all amendment are there because of for a couple of reasons. One is a practical situation where throughout the years, whenever we've seen any potential problems from our perspective relative to biodiesel, we've tried not to just stand back and say, you know, too bad, or that's not true in those cases, but we've tried to address them. And I could give you examples of that over the year. Over the years, when we first started with biodiesel, we did have some problems with some cold flow issues. And one of the requirements in the 2008 bill was that before you could move forward on to B10 or B20, that you had to put into effect ASTM standards that would address quality of fuel in order to be a fuel that will work in today's conditions. And so that was done. It was part of the reason that biodiesel was delayed to go to the B10 level 2 years beyond what the date was in the law. The law had stated in 2008 that the B10 would go to, in the year 2012, we would go to B10. It was delayed 2 years beyond that because the three commissioners did not certify that all the conditions were met, but they have been met now. I wanted to just briefly, in a very general way, tell you that what Minnesota has done in terms of leadership in this area has made a significant difference nationwide. And that, in our opinion, is tied to some of the debate at the present time. When the original B2 legislation was passed, 25 million gallons of biodiesel were produced in the United States. Last year, there was about 1.8 billion gallons that was produced in the United States. The significance of that is that there are significant reductions. Biodiesel is one of the only fuels, well, it is the only fuel that meets the federal EPA standards of 50% reduction in greenhouse gases at the B100 level. In addition to that, it has significant reductions in particulates and other kinds of problematic emissions. And so because of that, it has made a significant contribution in that area as well. Relative to the bill itself, we have had discussions with a number of people who oppose the move to B10. We have not, by any stretch of the imagination, through this amendment, solved from their perspective all of their issues, but we feel come a ways. And sitting in the audience, for instance, there are several people here from the mines and the railroads and also the petroleum marketers who have worked on this particular amendment to take a look at some of the changes that are there. And I'll briefly talk to one of the changes in the amendment is that it delays the timing in which B20 would be a possibility of moving to. Presently in the law, that date is 2015, and we don't think it makes much sense at this point to go to B10, which we are very supportive of doing, and then immediately turn around a month later and switch to B20. So because of that, there's a delay here to 2018 in the law. In addition to that, there was always discussion about cold flow issues, and that's the reason that we believed in 2008, Governor Pawlenty had proposed to go to the higher level blends year-round. We did not, from our perspective, working with biodiesel, did not feel that was appropriate, and so we had moved it to summer months only, what we considered to be summer months only. But the issue has come up this year in discussions with people, concerns about October. And the concerns about October basically generate from the position that probably October's not that cold of a month by itself that there's a problem with anything, but if you put it in a tank and it sits there until January and then you try to use B10 in January, you could have some potential problems. And so because of that, we felt that it was important to take out the month of October. And beyond that, I think there's one other consideration here, and that is that we've always excluded number one diesel from the use of biodiesel, and the reason is that it's a low aromatic fuel, and it acts differently with biodiesel than number two diesel does. And because of that, we excluded number one. But it used to be that you could get number one at any of the terminals in Minnesota, and now, as I understand it, I guess I could get a nod from our petroleum marketer guys, but I think it's down to two or three places. It's all that's left that you can get it from. And particularly in a winter like this where number one is used to blend with number two diesel in order to lower the point at which they find gelling for regular diesel fuel,
it was important to allow them to stockpile in the summertime, and the original legislation just exempted it during the winter months. But now they believe they're going to have to stockpile in the summertime in order to have it available in the wintertime. So we understand that, and so that's there as well. The last part of it is the exemptions, fact that the exemptions would finally be go back to actually what was the original state of the legislation in 2002, and that was originally there was an exemption, at that time a permanent exemption, for most of the exemptions that you see there. If you want, I could speak to each exemption as to why it was there in the first place. Very briefly, in the case of Coast Guard vessels, it's not because it doesn't burn in engines. It's because they have a different way that they use water to put into the fuel tanks, as I understand it, to do the ballast so the ships don't tip over when the fuel is used out of them. And they use a centrifuge then to get the water and the fuel separated, and biodiesel centrifuges out differently than regular diesel fuel. So that's the reason for that one. Nuclear power plants, I don't have any idea if it works in generators and nuclear power plants, and I don't want to find out. So so that was part of that. It's a nuclear regulatory issue. Relative to railroads, they have their own reasons. Their locomotive engineers have approved, I believe, up to B5, but not above. And from a practical standpoint, they can bring fuel from, the Amtrak goes through from Chicago to Seattle every day, and it can stop anywhere it wants to get fuel, so we're not objecting to that. In addition to that, in terms of mines, we have not had the testing available on the large super trucks and so forth that they've got in those mines, and we had hoped over years that if we delayed the sunset that some of that could be done, but it hasn't, and so we're going along with that. And also in terms of the timber, it's a unique situation in that they pull a tank out in the middle of winter and 30 below weather, and we can, we believe that biodiesel burns fine in those engines and all like that, but in terms of the fuel distribution system, there are some uniquenesses to it that we accept as well. So we've agreed to those exemptions. In terms of the electric generator that started with this original bill today, we understand that it's a unique situation, less than 100,000 gallons, that's involved only in testing and verification. So this does not meet everybody's objections, but it goes a long ways for a lot of people, and so we are here for two reasons. One is a practical one and one is a political one. So, Madam Chair, we would ask that you support the bill and send it on to rules.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. By increasing the minimum amount and decreasing amount, is there a net increase or decrease in the total usage of biodiesel?
Mr. Schoenfeld.
Madam Chair, the total usage would increase about 20 million gallons.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Mr. Schoenfeld, looking at the amendment about going to B20 in the year 2018, will those same four protocols have to be met, or are there different criteria for
no, they,
to go to B20?
They do, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair. Representative, the same protocols would have to be met, and that would include the amount of availability within the state.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. And this is to Representative Johnson. Your exemption talks about generators tested and used places where they don't require biodiesel. So does the company we're talking about have some a product that is used in Minnesota, and would that be tested then with our biodiesel?
Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, it would be, and indeed those generators work just fine on biodiesel. But it's a matter of competing. I'll just make up a country. I don't know if Thailand has biodiesel or not, but let's assume they don't. If MTU Onsite Energy is going to compete globally for the diesel generator market in Thailand, it's reasonable to assume that those consumers want it tested and power output tested on regular diesel. And so for them to be competitive internationally, that's why they need the exemption. But no, biodiesel works fine in those generators that are sold here and in other places where they're all over the market. This is a very this is a progressive, this is a big company, and so that's, I think that's pretty logical to understand the, their need to compete internationally in that fashion.
All right, is there anyone else in the audience who wanted to testify? I guess Mr. Schoenfeld is the only one we had on the list, so if no one else is here to testify in support of this or in opposition, and there are no further questions, Representative Johnson.
Madam Chair, thank you. I ask for your support on this bill, and I renew my motion that it be sent over to the Rules Committee.
Thank you. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. All right. Thank you very much, Representative Johnson, Mr. Schoenfeld. And thank you to the audience members who helped to craft this, because it's a good compromise, I think. Yes, Representative Hamilton.
Well, this was a popular topic. We should be debating this all the time, so we have this many people in the room. So this is fun.
Well, actually, tomorrow I think it will be. We'll have a few people here as well, because we have FFA Day, I think, as well. So we'll have maybe some people in the audience. And Representative Clark, we are. This, again, is an informational hearing. That means that there won't be any votes taken on these bills. What we're doing is beginning a discussion about urban agriculture. It is something that is near and dear to Representative Clark and to those that represent metropolitan areas. They understand it maybe better than some of us, at least who live in greater Minnesota. So what we're seeking is to get some more information about it. We have two bills that Representative Clark introduced, House File 2110 and House File 2111. We will be addressing those as well, and I know there will be testifiers regarding those. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And committee members, if it's okay with you, there's some folks that have to leave early who would come to the second bill or the first bill, so if you don't mind, they'll probably be addressing both bills, and basically I'll just give you the crux of each bill. The first bill, 2110, basically says that urban agriculture and those folks who are doing it would be eligible for the same kind of loans and grants that are available to from our state for some of the rural programs, the ones that fit. And the second bill says that cities and over 60,000 would be asked to develop agricultural zones. And the reasons for both of those will become obvious, I think, in talking with the folks. Is we're talking about the need in our urban areas for people to be able to grow food to eat. Food justice is the issue, the unavailability of some of the food that is, or and very costly for some of the food that's not available to low-income people and people in the cities. It's a big movement. This is nothing limited to Minnesota. It's happening around the country. Urban agriculture is a big movement. We want to make sure that we can help it grow well here. And over the last couple of years, you know, the Commissioner of Agriculture has come and met with a number of folks in the cities and so on. I think we might, I'm not sure if we'll hear from the department today. We might, they had a couple of tweaks that they wanted to do to the bill, but which I don't have a problem with, and we might get to that. But mostly I wanted you to hear some of the discussion, and it's been very interesting. One of the agencies that would deal with, like, the part that deals with zoning in cities over 60,000, I did hear from those folks, and people have basic questions like, what is urban agriculture? Are you talking about community gardens? What are you talking about? So we hope that'll all become clearer today as we talk. And Madam Chair, I'm going to call folks who will address back and forth between those two bills. Some, as I say, some people have time constraints. So this bill, these bills were originally brought to me by the Council on Black Minnesotans, and so I'm going to ask, I believe they've been designated, Ed, I'm not sure if you're testifying or Michael Cheney, one of you is testifying from that perspective. Whoever you send up here, just send them up here right now. And then I have one person who has to leave early, and Francisco from South Minneapolis. I'm going to ask him to speak second.
If you will, just you can come forward and
you can all come up. In fact, why don't you
could
come back
sit behind?
Here, join me. There's several people. Bill Ziegler from Little Earth. You can all just come and sit here. We'll call on you as you need to leave.
And then we could have at least one sit at the table, or if we could pull up a second chair at the table too, if you need.
Yep. Come on, say two. Oh, I'm really proud to introduce this speaker. Safety Jones, who's not only a farmer doing incredible leadership here in St. Paul, but also has been helped hold an honorary chair at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Agriculture, and he can tell you more about that.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members.
Do we need the microphone closer?
Yes, if you could.
I'm sorry.
Great.
Once again, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Saytu Jones, and I am an artist. And one of the roles that artists play is to make the invisible visible. And so it's been my goal, part of my mission as an artist, to reveal the hidden parts of the food system that sometimes are only visible to us when we go into the grocery store. I want to first talk a little bit about, first what I should do is acknowledge and thank Representative Clark and the Council on Black Minnesotans for listening to the African American community specifically and the larger community in general, and then working together to introduce this legislation. I'm here today, though, not solely as an artist, but as an urban agricultural advocate. So today I want to talk about urban agriculture in general and why this legislation is important. I believe that access to healthy food is a right. I'm also here as a neighbor, believe it or not. I live 1 mile away from the capital in Frogtown. Frogtown is one of the most culturally diverse neighborhoods in St. Paul. It is also one of the poorest neighborhoods in St. Paul. It is a neighborhood with the least amount of green space per child. In Frogtown, there is more open space tied up in vacant lots than in parkland. While Frogtown is not quite a food desert, there are many food options available, but not necessarily healthy or locally grown food options. University of Minnesota research has found that weight gain is greater in neighborhoods where fruit is more expensive, which is one of the things that we find in Frogtown. 53% of the population, of the 15,000 people in Frogtown, are obese. 1 in 2 African Americans born in the year 2000, that's every other teenager that you see, every other black teenager that you see, will develop type 2 diabetes in their lifetime. Our current generation of young people rarely eat fresh fruits and vegetables or know how to prepare them, let alone identify some of them. The social disparities that prevent people from making better food choices were the issues that moved people in my neighborhood towards some type of social action. Frogtown Farm was one of the resulting actions and is a vision of longtime Frogtown neighborhood residents who seized an opportunity to develop a vacant 13-acre plot in the heart of the neighborhood into a green asset and treasure. We can often define neighborhoods like Frogtown, like the Near North Side, and like parts of the South Side by their pathologies. We prefer to look at the assets there and build on those assets. Frogtown Farm is a nonprofit neighborhood organization formed to make Frogtown into a greener, healthier place for the people who live, work, and play there. Working with the City of St. Paul and Trust for Public Lands, Frogtown Farms was able to create an urban farm within a new public park. This park will be located on 13 acres of land formerly occupied by the Amherst Wilder Foundation. Plans for Frogtown Farm allocate 5 acres of the 13-acre park for farm production and urban agriculture education. The land was purchased in December, thanks to $1 million appropriation from the City of St. Paul, and believe it or not, thanks to $1.5 million contribution from the State of Minnesota through the Legislative Citizens Commission on Minnesota Resources. This year, we will begin the process of preparing the soil for farming. The land will be leased by Frogtown Farms from the City of St. Paul. Within 4 years, all 5 acres will be in production. This will be the closest and largest farm to the state capitol. You all are invited to help us harvest and plant. The Frogtown Farm will produce soil, mulch, worms, and compost, as well as fruits, vegetables, eggs, honey, mushrooms, and syrup. In 2015 and 2016, products will be developed, test marketed, and selected for further development. The farming program's products will appeal to a wide variety of types of customers, including home gardeners, restaurants specifically within the Central Corridor along University Avenue, groceries and co-ops, and consumers. This never would have happened without the support and love of our neighborhood. We had to build a movement within the neighborhood to make this happen. And we recognize that this is unique in the city with being able to receive that much support. But now we have to do it. We have to create this farm now that the land has been acquired. These two bills before you will provide an equitable and fair set of supports for initiatives like Frogtown Farm and neighborhoods like Frogtown. Urban farming needs the same tools that other small farmers need, and House File 2110 can provide that. In addition, House File 2111 will provide the support for integrating farming as a community planning tool, just like we have done in Frogtown. I urge you to support this legislation for urban farming. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Are we taking questions at this time?
Sure. Yes, I think so. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Clark, thank you for bringing this forward. And Mr. Jones, thank you for your testimony. I want to be part of the, I want to be involved.
Great.
In some way, shape, or form. It's interesting. Just a little background. I took a trip to Laos here in 2010, Hmong delegation, and asked if I'd go with. And during that trip, they said, you know, Rod, we are farmers by nature. And this was my good friend. I have Shia and Sang and Chupang. I mean, these are my friends, right? Saying, Rod, we're farmers by nature. And after the Vietnam War, we're taken from the farm, if you will, and dropped in to the cities, and a little bit out of our element, right? And so they're saying we're looking for avenues as well to get back to farming. I've also done some work with Ramon Leon. He works at the university. Maybe you know Mr. Leon about some similar objectives. I was. Also, and I'm rambling here, Madam Chair, but I'm excited, too.
Okay.
I serve on a board or on a group to work with St. Paul School Districts and to bring agriculture back into the classroom. And we've been working with Humboldt High School and Highland Park High School to do that very thing. And to see these children that are excited about agriculture gets me excited as well. And the last little story here, too, is I have a newfound friend, Officer Williams of St. Paul, and he talked about, he and I were sharing stories about us being young and, idle hands get in trouble, right?
Exactly.
Sort of things. And he said, Rod, back in the 70s, we used to have a program called the JOY Program, Job Opportunity for Youth. And it was offer it up to the city students, if you will, to where they could farm, do urban agriculture. He said, we're planting, whatever, crops all over the city back in the 70s, and it gave him something to do to keep him out of trouble, just like, I used to get in trouble, right? We all did. And I did. So I'm really excited about all this. And my friend Tua is located in Frogtown as well. And so I'm working with him in the city of St. Paul about opening up the ordinances to where they could provide products, and this particular live poultry, to the people in which he serves. So I want to be part of the solution, my friends, in some way, shape, or form. Representative Clark, thank you for bringing this forward, and I appreciate, Madam Chair, the dialogue.
No, thank you so much.
Yes, Mr. Jones.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Madam Chair, and thank you so much for those comments. One of the things I also want to say is that Frogtown, like parts of the near north side, parts of South Minneapolis, are many times the first homes for the most recent immigrants, or wherever they arrive. And one of the things that we need to remember is that many of these folks who are coming are either farmers or first-generation farmers. Mm-hmm. And not too long ago, 100 years ago, we didn't really make a distinction with urban agriculture. I mean, it was a part of the social mix. It was a part of our landscape and streetscape. You know, 120 years ago, believe it or not, Western Avenue, a half a mile away from here, was called that because it was the western edge of the city. And farms were all beyond that. And we want to reach a point again where urban agriculture is a part of the solution. What you saw on your visit to Thailand was something that is not unique. It is something that occurs throughout the world where people are farming within the city limits or in the first ring of suburbs right outside the city.
Thank you. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
I'm sorry, Mr. Yes, Representative Dill. Go ahead.
I'm thinking about my very good friend, as many of the legislators know, Cy Tao, and he moved his whole family, his dad, his mom, his whole operation to Florida.
Right.
And I can tell you, I've been there, and he's farming up a storm, and his dad's really farming up a storm. And one of the things that he talked about was that. What Representative Hamilton and you have said, that that opportunity really didn't present itself two blocks away from the Capitol where they live. But my question is to Representative Clark, how many cities does 60,000 capture in the state?
Madam Chair, it's 12.
12.
Yeah, I talked with the Metropolitan Council folks yesterday, and they had figured it out. It's 12. And I can give you the list if you want.
Madam Chair, I just wondered, you know, how many that caught. I know Duluth, obviously, a city of the first class, but
our major cities, and then a number of near, first-ring suburbs. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to see Representative Tao on the 14th. We're going to be deep sea fishing together now. So I'll mention this bill to him. He will like this idea.
If I could, Madam Chair, just mention several Hmong farming organizations have been part of this movement here in Minnesota and are very active. And as some of you know, if you go to some of the farmers markets, some of those produces are grown right in the inner ring. Others are grown further out, and some are being grown in the city more and more.
All right, Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just... What's that?
Mine's shorter.
Oh, yours shorter, yes, and you're more senior. No. I didn't mean it that way.
More ways than one. Social Security aid almost.
Oh, man. I might not be able to say anymore. I'm getting myself in trouble. This sounds like a very exciting program and very encouraging because I'm a farmer. My acreage is much different because I'm in rural Minnesota and have been I think I'm a fourth generation farmer. I'm kind of curious, when you talk about tools for a 5-acre piece, what types of tools would you be looking for?
Mr. Jones.
Madam Chair, Representative Keel, in particular for Frogtown Farm, for this new entity, and one of the things, let me back up a little bit, one of the things that we have been looking at the University of Minnesota and the College of Food, Agriculture, and Natural Resource Sciences is hard data on farming in the city now, and looking at urban soils and transforming urban soils into fertile soils. Which is one of the goals of the premier urban farmer in America, Will Allen, and based in Milwaukee. And through his organization, Growing Power, he's got three goals. One is to grow community through farming. The other is to grow farmers, to actually train people to grow farmers. That's actually one of the things that we have been exploring at the university as well. And Will and I, in our short tenure at the university, worked to develop a new undergraduate program in sustainable agriculture. You know, so, and that was because more and more students were demanding that. And so that is really what's shaping this, is the market itself. And this initiative working toward food justice. The third thing that Will Allen wants to grow is soil, and really beginning to transform that soil. Now, one of the things that we're looking at and exploring, and at Frogtown Farm in particular, is the effect of farming on the heat island effect in cities. And so just to be able to do that kind of research and develop that kind of hard data in farming is really key and important, and that's what this new legislation would support in particular.
Okay.
Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I look at this, what you need is some good Red River Valley black dirt. Mm-hmm. It's got a lot of nutrients in it. But I live in a valley area where the soil is very, very rich, and you don't have to go very far from me in to the east, and it's pretty sandy. So, mm-hmm. A lot of different conditions for soil. My other question is we're talking about doing this, and I think about it's wonderful to be able to harvest all this off of your garden. But it's also because of our winters, we can't grow very long. So I think it's really important that we teach people how to preserve all of those products too. And so my question is how many of our schools in the St. Paul area, and I don't know if you would know this, still have access to family and consumer. In my world, it was home ec, but it's family consumer life science classes that would help students. I know there's kind of a movement away from that because of dollars and the cost of those classes, and of course we don't have the instructors we used to have. But I think I'm just wondering how much of that would be accessible to our students so that they would also have that, or public in general. I know the Extension Service does some of that.
Exactly.
But we've lost a lot of that also.
Right.
Mr. Jones?
Madam Chair, Representative Keel, other folks behind me may have a specific answer to that, but one of my comments and observations is that the newest high school in St. Paul is Gordon Parks High School. And Gordon Parks High School reflects an unfortunate trend in new school facilities, in that it was designed with a minimal kitchen. And the University of Minnesota has partnered with Gordon Parks High School to help develop an urban ag program. Part of that is also looking at processing and preserving food. Institutions, unfortunately, outside of the schools will have to pick up some of that slack, and that's one of the missions of Frogtown Farm, and also one of the goals of many of the organizations that are represented behind me here. Is to do just that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. I wish you the best. This does sound very encouraging, and I can appreciate some of the differences in the metropolitan area where my in-laws have a very enclosed yard and some asphalt on it. So I know when we grow vegetables there, mm-hmm. It really absorbs a lot of heat. So because of the protection and the pavement, it really, my mother-in-law had a beautiful vegetable garden and flowers too, but that really, really provided a lot of nice heat. And of course, we're a little colder up north. It's about 5 hours north of here, so you definitely have warmer temperatures. But anyway, I wish you the best. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Erickson.
Good morning.
Distracted momentarily. thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I'm from up in further north than Representative Keel. I'm a driver and a three wood away from Canada. Yes, I am.
Yeah.
I'm having a hard time. The farmers up in my neck of the woods would have a hard time turning around in 5 acres of soil. So, if you could give me a picture of what these 13 acres look. How does that relate to like a city block? I'm just trying to get my. I think a football field is like 2 acres,
mm-hmm.
so 5 would be like 3 football fields together. What does it look like now, and what is your vision of it 3 or 4 years from now?
Mr. Jones.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, this farm that we're creating in Frogtown will be developed over time. It's going to take us 2 years to build the soil. And we have been saying over and over again that this is not, when Wilder Foundation moved off the site 4 years ago, we saw this as this great opportunity, as I said, to create this green asset. It's located on a six-block site. This site is actually a holdover from the Sisters of Good Shepherd, who built a convent there and church in the 1880s. They were on this piece of property for 60 years before Wilder bought it, purchased it from them. So there's always been this sense of environmental stewardship to maintain this contiguous area there. The area, believe it or not, was mined for sand. It is very sandy soil. And it was mined all around the Sisters of Good Shepherd, creating this donut hole, so that it is now one of the highest points in St. Paul. The third highest point in St. Paul is this hill that was left behind. And as I said, it's on a six, the 12 acres is on a six-block site. About three square blocks of that will be dedicated to farming. And we're looking, we're right now developing the marketing plan and strategy. We're going to be growing niche crops, and also in response to Representative Keel's suggestion about the, or comment on the length of the season here, you know, through work by Growing Power, and actually even through work by Women's Environmental Institute, founded by Representative Clark here, we're looking at ways to extend the season through hoop houses. And we will be growing, as I said before, fruits, vegetables, and really concentrating a lot on fruits and fruit trees in particular. Right now, that's what we're aiming at. And you're absolutely right. This is a different economy of scale altogether that we're focusing on. And there are folks behind me that can talk more about the business model, that particular business model. It's more of developing a profit from small acreage. Although Will Allen in Milwaukee claims that he can get almost $200,000 per acre when you look at all these different revenue streams that come in, that include education, that include selling soil, as well as fruits and vegetables.
Yes, Representative Erickson.
In the part that is going to be the park, or is it part of the model to like plant fruit trees in that acreage also, instead of, you know, and expanding that possibility?
Mr. Jones.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, the stepping back a little bit, one of the things that really got residents of Frogtown going was the possibility of losing our only sliding hill in this relatively flat landscape. And that really was a thing that marshaled all the residents together, was to save this sliding hill from development. So part of this land has always been used for recreation. And we're even rethinking the way that parks create space for recreation. And one of the things that we're going to create on the landscape, and even in the parkland that's going to be managed directly by the city of St. Paul, are fruit trees. And so we're planning on planting literally hundreds of fruit trees over the next few years. And at some point in time, I'll make sure that this committee gets an invitation to our big tree planting, that all our tree plantings that will be going on then.
Very good. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. And I'm sorry I had to step out for a minute, but maybe this was said, but Representative Keel talked about the growing seasons and being different. And where I live in South Minneapolis, we are Zone 5 now instead of a Zone 4, which is amazing. And I grow things in Minneapolis and, you know, in western Minnesota. And I have three or four weeks on either end that of the growing season that are different. And I'm going to say this, but I'm knock on wood when I say it. I've had a peach tree in my backyard in the cities for a couple of years, and this, of course, has been the hardest winter on it. And I've been looking at it, and I think it's made it through the winter. It feels to me like it has been. So I'll report that later. But it is amazing the difference in temperature or the ability to grow here versus western Minnesota. Yes.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Mr. Jones, for your presentation. We do have a number of people that are going to also testify. And
Right. Madam Chair, there are a number of people. I want to honor the child care needs of one of our witnesses. I think they just went out to bring him in, Francisco Segovia, and I'm hoping that he's here because I know he needed to leave.
Sure.
There he is.
I'm here.
With his littlest farmer.
Okay, very good. All dressed, ready to farm, I see. Very good. Perfect. Well, welcome to the committee, and just identify yourself, please.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Francisco Segovia, and this is Camilo. And we are here to testify for this bill. And I have been in Minnesota since I came from my home country 24 years ago. My first place to move in was Phillips. And now I am a director of a community center in the neighborhood, Phillips. And about 4 years ago, we embraced the concept of food justice. At the community center, we serve food. We have a hot meals program, and we call community cafe. It's basically an evolution of the soup kitchen concept. So our community cafe is not longer a soup kitchen. It is a pretty fine place where free meals for people who are homeless or have hardship finding food. About 2 years ago, we became part of this 24th Street concept, which basically was like a urban farm. And recently, we put together a little farm that has become the icon of Phillips, but many other places in the country have been calling about it, have inquired, how come or what is it that you are doing? The place wasn't only a place for growing food, but it's a place where people have gathered. And so an empty lot has become a social icon for food, for growing food, for people who are being reintroduced to farming. I myself, when Grandpa used to tell me to farm, I hated it. It's a lot of work. It's tough work. And so coming to the United States, and recently I began understanding the importance of eating fresh food. And like myself, there are so many immigrants from Latin America who are very much interested in being reintroduced to farming. So basically my request is support this bill. It's important. And again, it's just shaping communities. The social network that happens by farming and by growing food is not only impacting our health, but also our capacity to turn things around. At the community center, for instance, we have a culinary school for youth. So we bring a lot of youth, high schoolers, that are introduced to cook fresh meals. And we don't expect that everyone is going to become a chef, but we are introducing new values. And obviously, every one of you is welcome to come, and the food that we serve is pretty fine.
It's delicious.
Very good. Where is it?
It is in Phillips neighborhood, 2323 11th Avenue South. What we did is that the community cafe, we turned that into a training place as well. So many of the youth that comes and learn about cooking, we have two chefs, and many of the people who comes and learn basically end up cooking for the community members. And people take a test, serve test, and we place them in jobs. So we are turning that space into a training facility. And many of the food that is grown across the street in this corner farm that we have created, many of the fresh food comes to the cafe as well and is served back to the community.
Very good. Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
And we have a number of other people.
Yes, we'll keep on going, Madam Chair. Yes. I think Bill Ziegler is here. Bill can talk about, well, I'll let him speak from the beginning, but he's got, I think one of the bills is particularly relevant to the farming that he's doing.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Ihaniwash Day, good morning. My name is Bill Ziegler. I am originally from the Kuwichasha Lakota tribe in South Dakota. I'm also part Dakota from Crow Creek, so originally from this land before all y'all got here. I am currently president and CEO of Little Earth Denied Tribes. I've been on the job for about a decade now. I agree with everything that's been said up to this point. I can never say it as elegantly as they did, so I'll just speak to what I know. I know poverty. I'm not sure how many of y'all grew up in poverty. That's been the story of my life. Growing up on a reservation in South Dakota, it wasn't for lack of effort on my parents' part. Everybody on a reservation was poor. I never saw fruit growing up. The only vegetables I ever saw or tasted were from a can from the government rations program that all Indian people, that's how we survived. I also, for a time in my life, after I started my family, lived on food stamps and was raising my family on food stamps, which is why I'm here today. I was tired of being poor. I was tired of raising my kids poor, and I had to seize an opportunity to leave my reservation, first generation of my family, and move to the big city to try to do something different, provide something different for my children. Now, thinking about the fact that I had no access to fresh fruit or vegetables in the 70s and 80s growing up, I always assumed that it was a situation of access, right? Now, you would think, growing up on Lower Blue Reservation, where you have this vast farmland, or tribe has a farm that's the world's largest producer of popcorn, the vegetables were there. They just weren't made accessible to the community members or the tribal members that lived there. Everything was shipped off the reservation. So my thought when I moved here is that it would be different, right? Poverty, for some reason, I thought poverty would look different in the city. Now, it has been different, and it's been, I think, a lesson that I've had to learn. But one thing that's been constant, and there's many things that are constant with poverty, I've often found that a lot of the issues that we face in the American Indian community, they're not Indian issues, they're poverty issues. The accessibility or consumption of fruits and vegetables, I think, are a poverty issue. I think about Little Earth, and we're in South Minneapolis, about 24th and Cedar. We're the largest concentration of American Indian people in any city are right here in Minneapolis. But our people weren't eating fruits or vegetables. It was no different than my remote reservation in South Dakota. So I really started looking at this and trying to understand it. And really what it comes down to, besides access, and that's why the fact that we have our own urban farm, and I'm with the farmers. That's not from South Dakota. I don't understand that the urban farm, it's a garden, right, is what I see. But the fact of the matter is, when you look at the city and the value land of the city, if you're taking any land for farming or for gardening, let's call it a farm, right, because that's a big, expensive land. So anyway, I'm looking at the situation, and our people in Little Earth, they're not eating fresh fruits and vegetables. Again, it's not necessarily, I guess to some degree, it's an access issue. Now, we have Cub Food, we have Rainbow Food, we have Target, we have places that are a couple miles away from us. But if you have no transportation, you're depending on public transportation, you're touting a bunch of kids along with you, it's awfully tough to get to the grocery store. But the greater barrier, in my opinion, is if you're in survival mode, if you're living in poverty, if your whole life, if your parents' life, everything you've ever known is poverty, the last thing you're thinking about is the things that you're putting in your body, right? You're living paycheck to paycheck or month to month. You don't care about what's healthy for you. You're trying to survive. And I've been there. Listen, it's easier for me to go to McDonald's and buy my kids McDonald's because they'll shut up. I'm not going to worry about, you know, is this healthy for them? I'm just going to feed them so they'll leave me alone. And that's a reality of poverty in many of our communities. So what I've witnessed with our little community garden or our little urban farm, what I've witnessed is a slow transformation. Now, we understand that we're not running a sprint. This is a marathon. Community change is a marathon. Healthy eating is a marathon. It's going to take time. We've been growing for 4 years in our community. And what I've witnessed, frankly, is nothing short of amazing. We have young people who will pick of fruit or some vegetables over hot Cheetos. Do you know how big that is? To pick a banana over hot Cheetos, that's huge in our community. Even birds eat hot Cheetos at Littler's. I actually saw a little bird with a hot Cheeto in its mouth, and I thought it was the funniest thing. My staff didn't think it was funny, but I thought it was funny. So I'm seeing young people make different decisions. I'm seeing our young mothers in our community through the community groups that we conduct, our mother's group and our women's group, the introduction of food right from our farm. We bring into our community kitchen, and our mothers are learning how to prepare meals for their children with the food that they've grown. So we've slowly seen this grow. I wholeheartedly support both of these bills, and I would encourage y'all to do the same, because it's not just about what constitutes a farm and a scale of it, etc. It's about community change. It's about access. It's about accessibility. It's about really taking one of the biggest issues in this country, the cost drivers being health, and actually making a difference. We have an opportunity to make a difference in the health of people. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We'll just continue to bring people down.
Okay, all right.
If you thank would, you. Thank you.
Sam Grant?
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, and thank you for your time. My name is Sam Grant. I am a founder of a local organization working in urban agriculture called AfroEco, which has been a catalyst for the emergence of two other organizations working in the local community projects, PI and the Community Table Cooperative. And I was asked by the Council on Black Minnesotans, given my role on one of their committees, their Fair Housing and Civil Rights Committee, and also one of the members of the ad hoc group that asked the Council on Black Minnesotans to put together some language on urban agriculture. So I was asked to come and sit here and give you a brief definition of what it is. And so, since in addition to my work in urban agriculture, I'm also a professor at Metropolitan State University, I thought I'd just go online and look up the definition for you and make it really simple. And you know what? There's lots of different definitions. So it's not all that funny that people said, well, let's sort of get precise about the definition, but let's just make it simple. My colleagues at the Community Food Security Coalition put together a definition back in 2003 that I think is a relatively good, you know, general definition of the waterfront. Urban agriculture is the growing, processing, and distribution of food and other products through intensive plant cultivation and animal husbandry in and around cities. It includes green belts, farming at the city's edge, vegetable plots, food production in inner city lots. Urban agriculture comprises fish farms, farm animals at public housing sites, municipal compost facilities, schoolyard greenhouses, restaurant-supported salad gardens, backyard orchards, rooftop gardens, beehives, window box gardens, and much more. The potential for food production in cities is great, and there's dozens of model projects around the country that are demonstrating the utility, viability, and impact. Here in the local community, I think the best way to define something is to define it by the practice on the ground. And sitting behind me and in other locations around this room, there are people who are practitioners of urban agriculture. So you're seeing a few of the pioneers here in our local community that are, you know, putting this practice to place. And so, you know, I have to ask the question, why are we doing it? And why do we need support from the legislature to do it at a higher level? When you think about the dynamic of food poverty, people in inner city poor communities have access to food, but they tend to pay more for lower quality food. So we have what's called food swamps, which are places where you can get highly processed food, fast food, but you can't get access to fresh food on a day-to-day basis. And the communities that are food deserts, which is one of these fancy words being floated around, are communities that while they don't have daily access to fresh food within walking distance, they also are the communities that are facing the transportation divide. So you can't get in, you know, you can't get on a bus and quickly get to a place where you can get food. Many people are having to be on the bus for an hour, 45 minutes to go and get food. So many of us here in the local community are saying it's time for us to build on the amazing work that's being done around community gardening in the Twin Cities. Gardening Matters, which some of you may be familiar with, has a network of almost 500 community gardens that they support across the Twin Cities metro area. I think that's pretty amazing. But one of our young people in the community who was growing food asked one of our pioneer growers and leaders in the movement, Colley Graddick at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, what's the difference between a farm and a garden? And Colley made it really simple. A garden is a place where you grow food for yourself. A farm is a place where you grow food to share it and sell it, you know, with your neighbors. So if you're getting to the point where you're productive enough that you're putting farm produce out into the community, then you're farming. And here in the urban area, we are growing rapidly in our capacity to grow urban food. Project Sweetie Pie had 5 farm sites in 2011. It got up to 25 urban farm sites by last year. And it has 10 farmers who are now going through urban farmer certification. So we are quickly building significant capacity to grow thousands of pounds of produce right here in the city. The Community Table Cooperative is looking at getting a corner on the fresh frozen market and making it possible for us, regardless of what happens to the cost of produce in California, to have a local capacity, increasing community resilience right here in the Twin Cities urban area to make sure that around the year we have more and more capacity for food. We've got Candy sitting over here behind you all, who is one of the pioneers working on the Worth Food Cooperative, which is going to bring a cooperative grocery store to North Minneapolis, which would be an amazing achievement for us, and which will significantly increase access to fresh food there. Sitting behind me over here, I have some of the leaders of Appetite for Change that have organized the Fresh Corners Project, which is created an aggregation table at the farmers market so that it's possible for people who are growing at a very small scale to have the opportunity to make some revenue each year through urban agriculture. These are just a few of the many examples of the significant work that we are doing. And we feel like the bills before you are going to significantly advance our capacity. So if we make it the norm that when a community does planning for what's going to happen to build the community, that it incorporates urban agriculture and larger level green zoning, you know, kind of considerations, that we're going to be able to create a future in the North Minneapolis and all of the Twin Cities region that's going to co-produce greater community health, addressing the obesity and diabetes epidemic, but also producing new forms of community wealth. So right here locally, people are saying around the country that you can't grow food productively, they can't do it in rural areas productively, you can't do it in the inner city productively, but we're proving people wrong. We are actually helping people develop a hobby income on the side through urban agriculture, and we have a process in place now to significantly get to the point where people are going to be able to get about 20% or 30% of their extra income to support their livelihood and their households through urban agriculture. It's an exciting moment. If you all step up to the plate with us and pass these two bills, one saying we have to do the planning and another one putting some seed money on the table to help us leverage, you know, what we're trying to do in community agriculture, we're going to be able to hit the home run. And the state of Minnesota is going to be able to be an example for others to follow on how not only can you do urban agriculture productively, but how do you do it in a way that also helps to address some of the historic divides, making sure that everybody who lives in Minnesota has daily access to fresh food, and that everybody in Minnesota also has the opportunity to begin to relate in an organic and concrete way to the growing of food. People begin to get intimate again with food production, with nature, with all of the elements, and we all get healthier together and we all get wealthier together.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Keel.
Thank you. You spoke about, sir, excuse me.
Yes,
you spoke about, I didn't catch the name, Project?
Project Sweetie Pie?
Sweetie Pie?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think we may hear a little bit more about Project Sweetie Pie. Right?
We? Okay.
Well, we have another testifier, I think, that might talk about it.
Okay, awesome. I just was kind of curious, I think.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, maybe with that we'll ask for under Project Sweetie Pie to come up here.
Well,
and Madam Chair, how long do we have?
Well, we'll have to, I'll give you another 10 minutes for all the testifiers, because we have two people on the list that want to be able to testify. That's so just to keep it as brief as you can to get.
North Minneapolis is going green. Give us a call and learn what we mean. Where once lie urban blight, now sits luscious garden sites, gardens without borders, classrooms without walls, architects of our own destinies, access to food, justice for all. Hello, my name is Michael Cheney. I'm one of the founders of a project called Project Sweetie Pie. As I said, I grew out of Afro-Eco. With the threatened closing of North High, we were all sitting around commiserating about the killing of a school in North Minneapolis, because we believe that the killing of a school is the killing of heart of any community. And so in all good consciousness, we felt that we must come out and put together a grassroots movement to try to save the school. At that time, one of the criticisms of the school was their curriculum, and so we moved forward to try to advance horticulture to that process. And so, as he said, the first year we did 5 gardens. We had 50 partners the second year. We had 10 gardens. We had 75 partners. And then last year we had 25 gardens and we had 130 partners. And we frame it in the reference that we hear all this rhetoric that it takes a village to raise a child. Let's do a national demonstration model. What would that look like, and what role could each and every one of us in this room have toward the stewardship of our earth and the stewardship of our children? And so we come here today in the spirit of Horace Cleveland, Charles M. Loring, and William M. Falwell. All passionate and committed champions of the right of all citizens to equal access to nature, land, and the environment. It was because of their ardent belief in the sanctity of Mother Earth and that all citizens should have access to its splendor that made them powerful figures in Minnesota history. They were remarkable crusaders for the rights of all of its citizens. They were visionaries whose leadership helped create the Minneapolis Park Board in 1893. An independent governing board whose responsibilities included the creation of, maintenance of, and development of the magnificent park system that we enjoy today in the city of Minneapolis. As residents of that city, we enjoy a park system that is the envy of all cities across the nation. Through faith and hard-fought political battles, they created a timeless air room, a gift that has transcended time and improved the quality of all of our lives. And with it transferred that obligation and responsibility of sharing that nature's bounty with the children yet unborn. As good neighbors, as good stewards of the earth, we strive to leave the planet better than we found it. For nature is our common wealth and a treasure that we all share, regardless of our station in life, regardless of our race, creed, or color. I'd like to thank the Council on Black Minnesotans for the leadership of Ed McDonald and his staff, because they've done a superlative job in bringing all of us forward here today. And over the last year, they've traveled the state, conducted listening sessions, assessed the will of the people, and crafted a comprehensive slate of legislation offered by the support of Representative Karen Clark. And so it is time now to hand the baton over to you, Madam Chairman, and to all of your colleagues so that you can do your brand of magic. We come here today ask that you carry this bill forth into law. Urban farming is good ag policy because food security is national security. We ask that you now do your part in helping guarantee the future of urban farming, just like those men at the turn of the century guaranteed that land was set aside for parks. Passing this bill into law will help seal that fate. And what we ask today is not unprecedented. I turn your attention to northern Minnesota, to an innovative project entitled Victus Farm. This project features a unique partnership between UMD's Center for Sustainable Community Development, the City of Silver Bay. The goal is to develop an integrated fish, plant, and algae production system that will allow communities to create jobs producing their own healthy food and clean energy. Its mission, in addition to the production and sale of fish, fruits, and vegetables, fish feed, algae oil, compost, fish oils, the facility will be used for the following. Applied research aimed at improving production systems, economics, and minimizing resource inputs and waste output. 2, educational training for future system operators. 3, community education aimed at communicating the value of local and sustainable food and energy production. And I'd like to point out that the funding streams from that came from Minnesota State Legislation, $299,000, the University of Minnesota Sustainable Development Partnership, $5,000. And so what we're doing here today in North Minneapolis is asking the same thing that those residents in Silver Bay, that, you know, that we too are Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead and identify yourself, please.
My name is Peg Thomas. I'm also with Project Sweetie Pie. Project Sweetie Pie has 4 phases that we hope to move through. The first is scattered gardening, land gardens. The second is buzz, creating community opportunities to gather, to understand about food, and to make the behavioral changes that Mr. Jones has been talking about and Mr. Grant. The third is to begin to look at a season extension, as you were noting previously, we have about 2 months of summer, and we need bigger growing season. But we're also looking at dents. We're looking at hydroponics. We're looking at vertical growing. We're looking at the fact that agriculture in the future may look more like manufacturing. We may be finding ways to get fruit trees that are tall and skinny and produce in a vertical way rather than a horizontal way. So we're looking at dense opportunities to feed a number of people. And finally, we're looking at expanding the food production economic clusters into the city so that we have jobs for people who need them. We have some neighborhoods with 40% unemployment, and we need to do something fast. And we believe that agriculture, community agriculture, and city agriculture is an excellent opportunity. I'd like to bring to your attention that the United Nations on March 10th, 2014, urged cities to take food security into their own hands. I quote, by 2050, more than 6 billion people, more than 2 in 3, will live in cities. It's vital that cities identify logistical challenges and pressure points in their food supplies chain and develop a variety of channels to procure their food in line with the wishes, needs, and ideas of their inhabitants. Emerging social innovation in all parts of the world will show how urban consumers can be reconnected with local food producers while at the same time reducing rural poverty and food insecurity. Such innovations must be supported, and we're happy to ask you to support ours. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I've got some comments, but I think I'm going to wait until we get through the testifiers because
okay.
I want to hear what everybody has to say.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Clark, we probably do you have some concluding comments? We have a couple of people that are on the.
Well, let me just recognize the people that are here then that didn't get to speak, and if there is time, you know, after the other testifiers, that would be fine. I wanted to mention that we do have one of our council members, Cam Gordon, is here. Susie, I don't know if we're going to be able to have testimony from you right now. I don't know if we have time, but
if you can do it in 2 minutes.
All right,
presentation in 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
Well, I'll go and just say the one thing I wanted to add. I'm sorry. My name is Candace McKelvey. I'm a urban farmer. I run a youth program, and I'm a partner with Project Sweetie Pie. I'm also a member of Afro Eco. And one thing I wanted to add that Dr. Grant was talking about, and I heard someone say about home economics, one of the things we do is also teach the youth how to prepare their food. You know, hot Cheetos is addictive, so they're not going away. But to learn how to put a tomato on it or wrap it in some romaine lettuce or some kale is where we're headed, you know, and eventually maybe they'll grow out of that addiction to food. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I know there's not time, but I just wanted to introduce myself. I'm Zoe Holloman, and I work at Appetite for Change, a nonprofit that does community building and food justice work on the north side.
If there's more time, we can ask that several people, including our council member and one of the farmers from a place called Stones Throw. Well, if there's time after the other witnesses, I'll ask them to come up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And so we do have on the agenda here Patrick Hines and Patricia Naumann. So if they would come down and be able to. Just introduce yourselves for the records, please.